If Murray supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
Sending out good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes.
108 breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Garmeric Show. We are going to be chatting with Sheer Zed a little bit later about Thai tattoo magic, initiation, all sorts of fun stuff like that. It's a good one. Of course, you can skip all our lazy rounds, get right to the interview with the timestamp that is always in the show notes. So click on that. It'll take you right to the interview with Sheer. And we got everybody's favorite podcaster, Graham Dunlop, over here. How's it going?
Hey, good. Good. I'm looking forward to the 46 UFO videos being released by the Pentagon.
Really? When's that happening?
Today.
Today?
Yeah. No, I'm not kidding, but it's not going to happen. But it was supposed to happen.
You don't think it's going to happen?
No.
What about? Are you celebrating Carney Majority Government Day?
Oh yeah, that too. Yeah, that's. I mean, what a time to be alive. This is amazing. All this stuff going on. Yeah, this is fascinating stuff. Yeah,
it is pretty interesting time to be alive, because if people remember, well, people probably don't know, but we had an election in Canada that just turned out as sort of a mishmash. You know, the Liberals kind of won, but not enough to control Parliament. They were like 6 seats short or something like that. So it was like a mishmash where all the parties sort of had to get along, at least in some fashion, to pass any legislation. But I mean,
or it was an opportunity for, like, for example, the Conservatives to just not, you know, assist with passing crazy legislation.
Yeah, or for them to topple the government sort of at any given time. If the other parties had all had enough, they could do a non-confidence and head to election. But I guess, like, what, five people, they had a by-election, and then five members of the Conservative Party switched teams, just crossed the floor and joined the Liberals, which I guess, I don't know, does that happen all the time? Because I don't remember this ever happening sort of in my lifetime, but I haven't really been paying attention. It does seem crazy that it just happened 5 times in 2 months.
It's happened before, but not nearly this many. But I think there was 10 offerings too. There was people coming forward with texts, join the dark side and stuff. Like, it's getting crazy.
Yeah. So people voted Conservative and got Liberal. I don't know how that works. Welcome to Canada.
I'll tell you, it's pretty funny seeing the arguments from both sides. The Liberals sort of justifying it. Oh, it's the people vote for the leader, not the party. And it's like, bullshit. You know that 95% of the people vote for the party. You're voting for the person that's running for prime minister. You just have your local representative.
Well, even if they're not, even at the local representative level, I mean, that's your only option. You get a couple options. It's not like there's 30 people on the ballot and you can vote for each of them. You get one Conservative, one Liberal, you get one each, and you got to pick between them. So it's not like, you know, you get to go about 40 people and decide who's the best aligned to your values. You got to pick that party. That's the way our system is. You got to pick the party that's aligned to your values and then vote for them. So I don't know. Crazy times.
Yeah.
But as of today, they do have complete control of Parliament. So no one can call an election on them anymore. No one can stop them from passing whatever legislation they want.
And they got a lot of weird things in the queue. I mean, that you really can't deny that there's some weird shit going on in the queue. Like the fear-mongering about the tyranny is kind of warranted. It's not really hyperbolic when you look at what happened during COVID and what happened since then and what they're trying to do with the gun confiscation and the hate speech stuff. I mean, it's getting pretty crazy.
It's getting crazy. Temperature is up. It's like we're getting past hot tub, but into uncomfortable boiling frog now. It was a little fucking hot in here, doesn't it? So, and of course, we're going to Easter Island. It's probably too late for you to come, but we're going to Easter Island in a couple of days, right?
Yeah, this is probably our, I don't know how we're going to do an intro for the one where we're at the Easter Island, but we will, this will be the last time we do an intro, but prior to leaving, right?
Maybe not. Because we don't fly out till Monday morning.
Yeah, but it's...
And I'm assuming you'll be here Sunday night.
Yeah, it's Tuesday. So I'll
probably pre-schedule that show. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe Sunday night you and I can just rip off a little something.
Yeah,
it won't be a full intro, though. It'll be more like... But yeah, I plan to have the episode for Tuesday pre-scheduled. So it should come out as scheduled. It should be... I think it'll be Scott Wolter, actually. But we're leaving Monday, first flight. I think our first flight leaves at like 9:30 in the morning to New York. They offered That's us the bad. Chance to upgrade to the lay down beds for $1,000 US a seat.
Oh my God, what? I mean, a lay down bed does sound nice on a long trip, but.
I know. I was like, an overnighter too.
But you know what? Lay down bed at 9 in the morning's not really, you know.
No. But they offered that. That was for the New York to Santiago flight.
What? Really?
Yeah. You can't afford it.
I know.
We just, you know, we can't afford it. It'd be nice. But.
How long is it again?
And that was just for the bid. Honestly, it's a bid system, and that was the lowest possible bid. The bid you'd probably get it for sure was 2,200 US.
Oh, my God. And how long of the flight is that?
10.5 hours.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, my God. That's going to be a long flight. I can't believe it's that long.
Do you think the internet will work most of the way? The problem with going transatlantic is the internet doesn't work.
Well, now it does. I think with Elon putting Starlink in the planes.
Have Starlinks on them now?
Some of them do, yeah.
It does help when you have internet. You can get some work done at least. I mean, it's an overnighter, so I guess the plan is you should try and sleep on the plane, ideally.
Yeah, that's the point of those. Well, I mean, that's part of the point of those, you know, overnight ones.
Yeah, I'm going to try and sleep. At least I got some audiobooks queued up for it. Shouldn't be bad. Shouldn't be too bad. I mean, the flight over to Easter Island would be fun because there'll be 20 of us on it. And then we'll probably do something. We'll report to you somehow. Probably we'll try to at least live from Easter Island. It seems crazy not to do some sort of something. I mean, it won't be live in the podcast, obviously, but if we can figure it out with the Starlink or the bandwidth, we'll try and do some sort of, I don't know how the quality would be because I'm not going to bring any of the gear, but. Maybe we can try and do a live stream on the phone or something like that. Or record something at least. We got to do something while we're on Easter Island. I mean, we'll probably never be there again. We got a Moai and everything. So we'll probably try and record something. It'd be cool if we could record something with the Moai.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Putting a big set of ear cans. Earphones.
I don't think they let you do that.
Doobie in his mouth. What?
I don't think they let you do that kind of stuff.
No.
Let's not get arrested on Easter Island. Anyway, it's going to be a hell of a trip. The next one you can get in on probably going to be that Serpent Mound Solstice Festival. It's cheap too. So check that out if you want to come hang out and party down 2026. I don't know when we've got an event this cheap coming up again. Honestly, I think you get in for like $500 or $800 for the camping spots, and it's you get two people for less than that. So check it out. Come along. We're gonna have a time at the Serpent Mound Festival as well. I'm gonna present there. I'm gonna interview Buddy there. It's gonna be a blast. We're gonna go to the festival and do our own thing. We're gonna do. Looks like Matheson's gonna be there to do some star stuff with us. Powell's going to be there to do some cold training and some breath work with us and all that kind of fun stuff. And we'll have the regular CAC magic going on. So check all that stuff out. What have you been up to?
Just do some, I had to paint a little bit, working like physical labor. And I was sore as hell. I'm so out of shape. I thought hockey would help, but I guess using muscles I haven't used in 6 months or whatever. And I don't know.
I was pretty sore on Monday. I was pretty sore. We rented 400
duck decoys.
Yeah, 400 goose decoys, snow goose decoys to add to the. Rented them. Yeah, we found a guy that rents them.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, we were able to rent 400 of them all weekend. 450 maybe.
What's the price of that approximately?
It was like wasn't that bad, man. Like $600 or $700. And it's not like just me, you know, there was six of us, so it ended up being like $100 each, basically. And if you want to go for a guide with a guide, it's like $300 for a morning, you know, or maybe $250 for just a morning hunt. We were able to get them for like $100 each, and we had Friday night, all day Saturday, and Sunday morning to hunt with them. And then we have a bunch. Like I have a bunch of them, socks, and I have about 150, I think, total. Jesse's got another 100. So we had about 700 decoys set up, which takes longer than you think. You think it takes a long time, but then it takes even, because they're not ready to go. All of them need the stake stuck through them. And you got to get them out there. The fields are soaking fucking wet. So you can't drive the truck in. So I got to use a quad with the sleighs. And you just basically take like a big landscaping bag full of fucking decoys out at a time. And it takes about 10 trips with the quad, 10 or 12 trips, just full of fucking. And the first couple are falling over till you figure out a system, you know, that really works well. But
so then you're leaving them out there for the whole weekend then in that one spot?
No, that'd be nice.
What?
So we went out Friday night, set them all up on what we thought was the X. It was the X when I was there the day before or 2 days before I was there. That's where the birds were.
The X marks the spot?
Yeah, the X marks the spot. So we went out Friday night and set up, like, not even all of them, but we set up probably 350 or 400 decoys and had a shoot and shot, I think, 16, which was not bad, decent. But we could see they were, we went back there in the morning. So then we were actually just we're worried someone's going to steal the fucking things, because that's going around now where people, I guess somebody, at some point this year, someone had their decoys stolen. Someone had their ice fishing gear left, because sometimes you do the same thing ice fishing, right? You fish till dark, just leave your shack and everything set up, go back in the morning so you don't have to haul it on the lake. So we're in that point of the decline now where nothing is sacred, even out in the middle of nowhere. So then we had to tear it all down. So that gets dark at 8:30, tear it all down, run it all back to the truck. That takes a couple hours, and it's an hour and a half drive home, sleep. I think we slept from, we got back here 11:30 and left at 3:20 back out on the road. But in the morning, set up all these decoys again in the dark, get them all set up for first shoot at 6:30.
Man, I would have just left the 350 there.
And then we missed the X. So now the we're not on the X. They're flying over us. We still shot 19, I think. But we could see them all landing in this other field up across the road. So then after the morning shoot's over, 11 o'clock or so, tear them all down again. Drag them all back to the truck. Take them down this road to this other, where this other field is. Get Miles' truck stuck in the field because he went off the range road, which was soaking wet and muddy, and I get it, shitty to get through. But as soon as you get off that range road onto the actual field, he sunk, dude, like fucking a foot, just like zoop. So he's stuck, and then me not learning the lesson, I just turn around to go pull him out, and I'm like, oh, I'll just turn out into the field. And like the second I got out in the field, I fucking sunk my 7,000-pound truck. Luckily, Jesse was able to just tug me out. Then I was able to tug Miles out, ripped off his fucking front bumper in the process, but it mostly popped back on. And then...
What an adventure.
Well, it was quite the adventure. It was quite the adventure. Then we started dragging out all the decoys again while Sean made us all lunch. A little barbecue out there, so he made us all a bunch of smokies. This time we weren't quite a rush. It's like that low where you get like 6 hours in between flights. So we had a bit of time. We had the quad out there. So we rip around, find where there's a bunch of fresh goose shit, set up all the decoys again. And now this time we set them up where we were in view of the Hutterite colony. So we talked to that Hutterite and was like, we're going to leave this shit out here.
and just make sure if there's any weird trucks around or something, you check it out type thing. It just feels safer. You have to be pretty ballsy to go inside of the Hutterite colony and start stealing shit. Anyway, we set them up there again, and then we did pretty good. I think we shot like 66 or 67 that night in like 2 hours. And that's when it was like proper good tornadoes of birds coming
down.
So
where were you staying? Like, or where were you hiding?
We would do lay down blinds on the ground. So it's like a blind.
Blinds on the ground?
You lay down on the ground, basically. You got this little fucking thing so your head's not on the ground. It's up on a little bit of an angle with a screen that goes over your face. Then you just brush it all in with the wheat trimmings. And then we have an e-collar that blurts out goose sounds. And then, dude, it's a sight when you get like thousands of birds, because those birds don't just land. They tend to like do circles around.
I saw a whole bunch.
So you got to watch them and wait for a couple, like it's a couple minutes of them circling down. And then they get a little closer and a little closer and then call the shot. Okay, next time we're going to fucking take them out. And then they'll come around and be like, okay, go. And then when the go guy yells, which is usually me, everybody pops out of their blind and fucking, you know, we try and blast the birds. If you're on the right, you shoot the birds on the right. If you're on the left, you know, you just sort of try and pan it out between the five or six of you. But yeah. And dude, when it's tornadoing like that, it's like you go out, you fucking shoot off your shots. A bunch of birds fall down. You get back in the blind. You're covered up in your blind, reloading your gun. And it's like they don't know what's going on. They just sort of keep coming. So, I mean, some guys do a good shoot of hundreds of birds, but we could have easily shot 150 if we were shooting well. We let some get away but this was the first time they were like landing in us. They were like, dude, there was one that landed and like walked over the things like two, three feet in front of my blind, just like doing his little goose call, looking at all these fake geese, wondering what the fuck is going on, probably.
Wild, right? So this was in a field. I kept expecting it to be in a water. You were in a field then, right?
Fields, yeah, and farmer fields.
Okay, the farmer fields, yeah.
And then that night we left them out. So we shot geese till just about dark, shot 65 or something like that. Brought them all back to the truck. So by now we're already up to 100 or so, just over 100. Then we went back out. We didn't want to tidy up that night anyway, right? It's late. It's been a long day. We've been up since 3. So I came back home, got home at 10, slept till 4, got up, bolted out the door. And we went down. We were in the blinds not for long. It was supposed to rain and snow. We didn't want to get stuck in the field. So we went, I'd say from 6:30 till 8 or 8:15 and shot another 30 birds, then cleaned up, and then came home and had to clean 80 birds.
It's weird because I intuitively, or what's the word to use, but you would think that when you take any kind of shot or make any noise in a big field like that, it would scatter them all over. But when I went out with you too, I realized like it's you take these shots on these ones flying by, and really that doesn't even, the ones that are still on their way in don't even really know what's going on. They're still coming in.
So loud and everything else that they don't know.
Walk everywhere. Yeah. And the wind.
This is 100 times the duck hunt. You know, snow goose hunting is special when you can get them like spinning like that, or even just scouting for snow geese. When you're like up on a hill watching a field and there's 50,000 fucking birds in it. Like you can't even see through the birds when they're spiraling up. All you see is birds. That's it. There's no like path through the birds. There's so many birds there. And then this is the first time we've finally been able, because we haven't done a guided thing. We've stayed away from it. We just kept trying and doing our own thing.
Oh, and this was guided?
No.
Oh. No,
but we just kept failing forward, you know? Okay, that don't work. Well, nah, that don't work. We'll try
that. Well, I mean, it's not that it doesn't work. I mean, it's...
You just learn more things, you know? But this was the first time we finally had a proper tornado coming down on us where it's like... I mean, what it really comes down to the most is scouting. You just got to know where the fuck those birds want to land. Because when you're where they want to land, they just keep coming back. Like we'd have it where all these birds come and they'd take off and they'd fly up north. And then like, you know, 5 minutes later, they come back because it's just built into their radar that this is the field that they've been feeding on. Then if you can get the thing where there's a couple hunting groups, a couple miles from each other. So they try and go from one field to another, and they keep getting sort of shot up and keep flying around.
What do you mean they go away for 5 minutes and come back?
Yeah, they fly a lot. You know, they're very so. Sometimes when you shoot them up, they'll leave for a while, and it'll get quiet. It'll seem like nothing's happening,
and then they'll come back though.
Yeah, like, oh, is it over? And then like 5 minutes later, you'll hear them fucking coming again.
Wow.
And the next thing you know, there's 1,000 geese above you, fucking doing it all over again. Pretty wild experience. A lot of work, though. I mean, a ton of work on not a lot of sleep. It's the same thing when Tony and them come here duck hunting. It's a little more work than that, but it's sort of the same thing because it's late nights and early mornings. And the thing about spring is when Tony and those guys come here in the fall, it's October. We're past the equinox. Maybe we're past the time change even. So it's dark at 5:30, 6 o'clock at the latest. Do the sun setting at 9? And coming up at 6, that doesn't leave a lot of hours in between to get off the field, get to your truck, drive home, eat, clean up, sleep.
There's a big difference between spring and fall, right?
Huge difference in hours. So now it's like you've got way less hours than you thought to get this stuff.
But you've got way more hours to hunt.
Way less hours to sleep. More hours to, yeah, but... I mean, with geese especially, we're hunting 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the evening, okay. Maybe even two.
So both. So either way, you're still the same hunting time.
Pretty much the same hunting
just
time.
Just more of a gap in the middle in the spring. Yeah.
Less sleep and time. Anyway.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, I saw
some. Yeah, it was fun.
What's your Instagram for people that like hunting stuff and want to...
I think it's Darren_Grimes_ still.
Probably not the best episode to talk about that. I think, I think the Sheer Zed and the Buddhist stuff really, you know, they're not into hunting.
They don't like hunting?
I don't think so.
That's a real shame. Well, support the show. GrimeAmerica.ca/support if you can. We do need some supporters around here. It makes a big difference. Helps keep the show going, keep the show on the air. I don't think we have any new supporters to mention this week, unfortunately. So I'm just checking quick now. Nothing. Tough week in Grimerica. Guess nobody likes the show anymore. Yeah. So wrap it up.
Wrap it up after 13 years.
Yeah, hang them up. Get back to making disaster maps. Disastermap.ca. Check it out if you haven't. It's a fun thing to play around with. Pretty soon we'll have the UFO map too. We're already working on that. Should I get the UFOmap.ca URL? No. Do you have a better idea?
I don't know. Jeez, I never thought about it.
Well, that's important.
Yeah, probably I would use UFO instead of UAP probably, but UAP might. There might be more opens for the UFO might not be available.
.ca is available. .com is not. I went to ufomap.com and there didn't seem to be a map there, which was weird. Anyway, I digress once again. People should check out that disaster map, though. It's pretty fun. People have fun with it. Cool way to check it out. And if you buy the pro version, then it's a good way to support us. Another way to support us is always good because it doesn't seem like you want to donate. So I don't know what else to do. Anyway, what else we got?
Oh, I think that's about it. I mean,
We're getting
audiobooks.
Audiobooks.
Let's mention Buddy's book that's out there now.
All right. Machiavelli Nation. You can get all the links to get there on adultbrain.ca. It's on adultbrain.ca now. Machiavelli Nation by Hannum. Check it out. We published that one for him. Helped him out with it also.
But it's a really good book that our listeners are going to love. So if you got Audible credits to use up, I mean, do that for any of our books on Adult Brain, but especially for this one, because help this guy's book sort of get some sales at the beginning, go viral a bit. It's a great read. It's a fun journey.
Absolutely. Check it out. It's a fun one. And like I say, you can check that out at adultbrain.ca. Support the show, grimeamerica.ca/support. Come on a trip with us. Most of all, enjoy the chat with Sheer Zed. Do you have a bio?
Yeah. So Sheer, He's an author, Buddhist shaman, and musician. He's been published through like Inner Traditions, Haitian Press, Indie Shaman, Rituals and Declarations, a bunch of them like that. He's released many albums, musical albums over the years. Let's see here. He's contributed to the Bristol Museum's exhibition, Do You Believe in Magic? Of course, he's part of the 90s counterculture, the whole thing. And his book is Thai Tattoo Magic, The Initiatory Practices of the Thai Buddhist Magicians, published by Inner Traditions. Sheerz.me is a website. And then books, Inner Traditions, The Thai Tattoo Magic. And there's links in the show notes to all that stuff.
Check it all out. Support the show. Enjoy the chat with Sheerz. No, it didn't do the countdown, so.
It did for us.
Oh, did it? I didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the show, Sheerz. Thanks for joining us. Are you all the way in across the pond in the UK right now?
Yes, I am, Graham and Darren. I am speaking to you about 10 miles outside of Bristol.
Oh, nice. Nice. Bristol always reminds me of Monty Python. I think it was the chicken of Bristol, I think, is...
I was just talking to my buddy in Leicester this morning, and he was saying that he was giving me the diesel prices.
Oh yeah.
I think he said it was like $13.50 Canadian per gallon.
Oh, that's quite a bit more than what we pay here. Yeah. It's
about double. I was like, man, that's like, that'd be like paying $4 or $4.20 a liter here in Canada.
Yeah, it's going there. It's, I don't know what's going to happen, but, things are being squeezed at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to talk about your book, Thai Tattoo Magic, The Initiatory Practices of the Thai Buddhist Magicians. Sounds fascinating, but I mean, I'm always curious because you've been sort of in this underground, Buddhist counterculture kind of scene, which some of it seems like a contradiction in some ways. So, but I'm super curious as to how people get into these environments. And was there something that, happened to you or what drew you to this so many decades ago back then?
Well, that's a very good question. And I guess when I was a child, I got exposed to Asian culture quite early. And there's this TV show called Kung Fu on TV in the 70s. And that kind of hooked me. You know, I really got interested in the philosophy. I was raised in a house that had books. My parents belonged to a book club, and both of them were avid readers. And so I was just fortunate to have that kind of environment, to have somewhere there were books where people could afford to have books. And the book clubs in the 70s were easy to join and to be a part of. And my parents belonged to a book club, and they just selected titles every month. And one of them was called Magic Words and Numbers by Stuart Holroyd. And that opened my mind to Aleister Crowley, numerology, tarot, psychic abilities, ley lines. And this is a lot to take on board for a young kid to absorb all of this, these ideas. And I was always interested in ghosts and supernatural, so my interest in esoteric subjects was quite strong from an early age, and I just naturally gravitated towards it. I had a predisposition. To answer your question specifically about the ideas of Thai Buddhism, my mother used to go to a sculpture class, and one day she brought home this sculpture, part of her, you know, in the local college. She was learning how to sculpt, my late mother, and she brought home this statue of Buddha. And I was just like completely enamored with it. I mean, just the shape of it. And I thought, well, who's that? What's this? And from that, I got interested in Buddhism and started reading the Beat Poets. And they're interested in Zen Buddhism. I got involved with a former Buddhism called Nishin Shoshu Buddhism in the early 90s, a group of friends. They really got into the idea of Nishin Shoshu Buddhism and were practicing. And I mean, I was interested, but I wasn't interested enough to fully commit to it. So I dipped my feet into it, so to speak. You know, I just thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. I met someone and ended up living in America in California and became interested in Tibetan Buddhism. And that really, really, and still really, really interests me. And I studied that and worked in a bookshop for many years. I didn't just sit around, drink coffee and read books and think I'm enlightened. You know, I was working many hours, just hauling skids in, very manual labor, really, with the rest of the team, truck to floor in 24, that kind of thing. 36,000 square feet of bookstore, fully locked and loaded for operation every day. I ran an international newsstand with about 2,500 titles from newspapers and things like that, journals, magazines. So it was kind of tedious. So having an employee discount and being able to buy like one copy of a book about ancient Tibetan magical practices was kind of a big thrill for me, and it made it worthwhile. So I was able to study mantras and start chanting mantras, and that was where I committed to starting to chant the mantra of Padmasambhava. This is in the early, around 1999, 2000, I started chanting the mantra for Padmasambhava. Om Mahang Benzaguru Pema Siddhi Hung. That is the mantra, and I started looping it and started acquiring visions, divinated visions of different aspects, which guided me and helped me to basically acquire and discern certain aspects of my existence. And I was privileged to be able to do that, to have a roof over my head and to be able to have a small but quiet practice. Then I got divorced and came back to Britain. My interest also has been with music. I'm a musician. And in the, I think the mid-80s, I started getting into a group called Coil. And I kept tabs on this group, Coil, experimental electronic group. And they got interested in going over to Thailand and interested in traveling around Thailand. And I thought, oh, it's kind of interesting. I've never been that far east before. And an opportunity arose for me to go there. And I started traveling to Thailand over a period of 7 years. I went there 4 times. And I came into contact with a group of individuals that are called Ajahns. And these are Buddhist technicians. These are really magicians, Buddhist magicians. And they are imbued with various powers. I think the term sensei in Japanese, a teacher, someone of great knowledge, is comparable to an ajahn. And gradually over time, I mean, I never really wanted to get tattoos in the first place. I mean, it's something that's kind of scared me, really. You know, just the idea of huge needles hammering into me. But actually, I overcame that fear, and I slowly became embedded into a culture that has completely and magically transformed me. So I hope that in some way answers your question, Graham.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it even goes on to, it was answering part of my next question, which was about the magical practices, because Buddhism can be sort of looked at as really kind of bland, sort of meditation, mindfulness kind of thing from a Western perspective. But your work seems to really tie in this magical, I don't want to use a cult in a bad way, but more of like a shamanic kind of a cult bent to it. So I was wondering if you'd experienced anything, you know, magical early on like that changed your mind about what Eastern Buddhism and all that is all about. And you kind of just described it with the ajarns. So was there a big difference between, like, were you initiated it with the tattooing? Was there a difference between what you did with the tattoo as a tourist would go and have a tattoo by them?
Okay. Let's unpack what you just said, because there's quite a lot in there. And yeah. Thank you for the question. It's a very good question. Many tourists go to Thailand, as you rightly said, and they go there to receive a spiritual tattoo. I don't like doing that all the time, so that's the only time I'm going to do it. and I hate when people do it as well. They go, oh, don't do that. So it is the term spiritual tattoos, and it's used often, and many people go to Thailand because they want a spiritual tattoo. What people do not quite understand is that, you know, you mentioned the word initiation. It's interesting. Somebody posted something about initiation, that big initiations are not necessary. I respectfully disagree with that. You can't read about an initiation and think you've been initiated. I try to be a good writer, and I try to write in as much detail as humanly possible about what I'm writing about so that people feel informed. But you can never, never replace experience. Experience and the feelings that you undergo while you are being initiated,
yes,
are wordless and cannot be articulated in text, because it is the feelings. And the feelings that are raised in an initiation are very, very different than just reading about something. You are taken on a journey. Magical rituals are a liminal portal. And as an initiate, so someone who is initiated, you go through that portal and you are experiencing something, and then you come out the other side and you are transformed. There is a transformation. And what people need to understand is when you receive Sakyant tattoo, you are having an encrypted magical spell placed onto your body. It is a real thing. Now, whether or not, and most ajahns have this on the wall of their samak, which is the place of work, where they work. It's not a tattoo studio. That is a completely separate thing. And I have enormous respect for tattoo artists. Tattoo artists cannot give people Sakyant and call them authentic. Because Sakyant is a magical form. It is a medicine. It is a very clear and unique form of magic that is applied to the body. And it is applied using very specific mantras and also in an environment that is magically enhanced. I've had these Sakyant done in front of a fully consecrated shrine. And that means it is a sacred act. It is a sacred and holy act, and one cannot treat it in any other way. It's not just a fad. It's not just a souvenir. It is a way of life. It is a commitment to a pathway. Muay Thai fighters, the Thai fighters that do very specific form of fighting, they have Sakyant on their body. And this is meant to imbue them with great power, but they have to live in an ethical manner in order for that Sakyant to retain its power. And on the wall, as I mentioned just slightly previously, Ajahns have clear rules that basically inform the person receiving the Sakyant what is expected of them. And the rules are pretty clear. I mean, one of them actually on Ajahn Deng's wall says, don't eat dog meat. You know, no trouble there. You know, I mean, I'm not interested in eating dog meat, and I never will. But there are other rules, and one of them is maintain the five precepts. And the five precepts in Buddhism are very clearly outlined. I mean, you know, I approach this as someone who was, well, you know, I used to be, well, I led a dissolute life. You know, I mean, I was a hardened pot smoker. I did quite a lot of drugs in my life. I mean, I was heavily into psychedelics in the 90s, enormous amount of psychedelics. And I've lived in that way. And then suddenly in 2017, I completely stopped all that and upheld the five precepts of Buddhism. One of them, do not take drugs or drink that changes or alters your mind. And I started walking this pathway, and all kinds of things started changing in an amazing and sublime way. To discuss that would take a very long time, but I decided to follow the five precepts, and this is to strengthen the value and the magical value of the Sakyant that are on my body. And that is important. It's these designs, these intricate, complex, beautiful Buddhist animist designs are nothing. They are nothing unless you have the faith and the spirit behind them with you as you practice. Some people take them on. It's a nice thing to look at. End of story. And some people want to have these magically protective things on their body. Let's just say that they are software for the body's hardware. And they are security patches. They work with your psyche, but only if you put in the work. You have to put in the work to make them work. The balance has to be drawn. You understand what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
Have to, you can say, look, I climbed Everest. Oh, did you? What was that like? Well, you know, it was pretty easy because I took a helicopter. Oh, Well, what you really need to do, or what you really need to say, is I climbed Everest and I climbed every single base camp. And then I got to the top. It took a long time. I nearly died, but by goodness, I did it. Wow, what was the benefit? I climbed Everest. You see, Crowley, he was a mountain climber, and he reflected this in his life. He was climbing mountains of magic all the time. Now, if you want to do that, if you want to be an icon of lived magic, great. But my interest in pursuing this pathway was in magical transformation, into changing myself in order to evolve and to become awakened. And a lot of people use the word in Buddhism, and you're right, it's dry. People think, hey, this is really dry. I mean, why do I want to? I mean, who wants to know about just sitting down and watching your breathing for hours on end? What's the point? The point is that you break through. You break through after many years' practice, and you become awakened. Enlightenment is not a word I like using. It's been badly translated from very early on. It's not a good word to use in Eastern philosophy, in my humble opinion. Awakened. Awakened is a far better translation of that word, that feeling. I don't know if this answers your question, but I'm just...
Yeah, it's great. I guess maybe just to drill in a little bit more about the tattoo experience, like, do you pick a design, and is it based on certain transformations that you want, or are you given one based on transformations that you might need? How does that work?
There are many forms of tattoo, as there are stars in the sky. And Sakyant is medicine. But then there's Sakyant, for example, one particular young chap. He was in the in Ajahn Deng's Samnak before I entered. And we had to wait for him to leave. He had a job interview, and I've mentioned this before previously, and he had these two, like, small tattoos on his throat, and they were placed there in order to improve his sense of speech. So he basically went into Ajahn Deng's Samnak before his job interview to improve his ability to speak eloquently. So there are many different kinds of Sakyant for many different types of magic, many different situations. Now, I have a Sakyant called the Soisan Wan, and that is across the top of my chest. Now, I didn't ask for it, but it was given to me. And it was given to me because Ajahn Sir, Ajahn Tiger, he through a vision said, I see you with this tattoo. And I'm going, oh, really? You know, and he basically diagnosed me as someone who required this Sakyant. Now, having an Ajahn diagnose you through a divination, through a vision, is something to go through. And if you have that, if you're fortunate enough to have an Ajahn diagnose you with a specific form of Sakyant, you take it. You take their advice, and believe me, it was not something I would naturally choose. And it was one of the, well, it was a peak experience. I went through levels of pain I never thought I would endure. You know, metal on bone through skin, hard metal through, I mean, you know, really cosmic levels of pain. But that is the essence of pilgrimage. The essence of pilgrimage is sacrifice. You sacrifice yourself in order to achieve a sense of peace. Some people, they travel many years. They are just worshipping the ground as they go to get to a point of pilgrimage. And, you know, I've had some people tell me, they're mentally ill. This is crazy. How how do you, you know, how are they doing this? This is just crazy. And Buddhist asceticism in Buddhism, asceticism, people who, ascetics who go through incredible ordeals in order to be closer to the spirit is something that does interest me. And that is something that encourages spiritual growth.
What happens if you, what about all these people that are getting tattoos in settings that aren't like that? Is there, are they just sort of like, like, I guess the best case scenario would be that there's just, they don't have any effect, or are they having some effect? Is there a negative connotation to having tattoos just by the tattoo guy? You know, it's sort of taken over the culture where everybody's got them. So what is this doing?
Yes, yes, yes. I think that's an excellent comment to make, Darren. I think that's a very good comment. What is this doing? Is this diluting the culture? Is this destroying the culture? I'll give an example. I noticed this gentleman from London went to Thailand. He was a hairdresser, and he went there, and he wanted Sakyan designs on his body, and he didn't go to an Ajahn. He wasn't interested in the spirituality, interested in the commitment to the pathway. He just wanted the designs on his body. And he went to a tattoo parlor, and he had designs placed on his back. And the tattoo artist was more than willing and happy to give these, but he wasn't trained. He wasn't able to initiate someone correctly into this. And the guy, he got his tattoos, and then sometime after, his hire car experienced critical damage when a tree snapped off and smashed through the front of his hire vehicle. You know, you're playing with fire.
So in that instance, he's getting these sort of, that he's getting the designs that have the power behind them by someone who's not initiated to give them. What about someone who's just getting like a skull and crossbones, or just like non, like, does it, like, how do these other, how do these other Western symbols fit in? You know, the, that sort of stuff, the tribal tattoos, the all sorts of different things we're doing, that maybe if they do have magic behind them, it's not clearly defined. So what kind of fire is that playing with?
Everything has magic. Everything, all things. As an animist, as a believer in that, I see all things as magical. You know, I'm going to pick this cup up. It is drenched with meaning. It is a magical cup to me. And now I'm going to drink from this magical cup. And I believe this has magical liquid. You know, tattoos, all tattoos are special and magical, because they have meaning. They're important to people. They mean things. And as you pointed out, Dan, how does this all play? I mean, when I put something on my body, what does it mean? Some people use tattoos as a form of healing. I mean, some people go through incredibly difficult periods of life, and they want to note this passing of something, and they want it placed upon their body. Tattoos have been around for thousands of years. We've been doing this since the Ice Age.
So is your intent enough, or does the intent of the person given the tattoo? Because you could have all the intention in the world, what you want it, it means this, it's got all these good connotations behind why you're getting it, but then the dude who gives it to you is, you know, hungover and doesn't give a fuck. He's just counting, you know, stacking Benjamin. Yeah.
It's everything. Everything is dependent. This is why when an Ajahn gives a Sakyan tattoo, they are mindful. And mindful means that they are precision honed. They are precise in what they're doing, how they're doing it. And when they do it, they're chanting a mantra, either vocally, quietly, or silently in their mind as they apply the design in front of on consecrated ground. I mean, this is why it's important not to dilute the practice, And I mean, I'm all for Western practitioners going over to Thailand and getting the training. But the thing is, there's a commitment. There's a very specific commitment to learning. And it's important that people follow that, follow the commitment. And there are some excellent Western practitioners of Sakyan tattoo. There are some who have committed their lives to learning it the correct way. I love design and the way design affects magic. I mean, there are many tattoos that people have, and they have their own magical presence. There's a book called The Illustrated Man. I don't know if you've heard of it. And that has always interested me, this idea of stories coming alive on someone, you know. I think everyone who has a tattoo, you know, has marked something, even if it, I mean, yes, the person that applies it and their intention is important. And also your state of mind is important because it's a snapshot of that time. It captures that point in time, and it is a time capsule. So when I started this process, and I didn't think I'd be starting a process, I didn't think I'm going to get a load of tattoos. It just, I mean, I didn't even want one to start with. And then gradually it was introduced to me. And then gradually I thought, okay, all right, well, I'll just try. The first one I had was actually invisible.
So if it's transmuting your skin, then, or it's a transmutation, then, in a way, then does the astrological significance matter too, then? I mean, if you're saying like it's a snapshot in time, then where the celestial map is makes a difference.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I've had Ajahns refuse the ritual because the day wasn't correct. I mean, they work on that level. They triangulate to the nth degree when they're going to do a magical ritual. Very, very specifically. I mean, to the day, to the hour, you know? I mean, these people work in detail, and they think, oh, this is, and they observe the charts that they have. They have sets of charts and books. They use astrology. It's the SCSI drive of magic in Thai magic. I mean, this thing runs everything, and everything is underneath it. It works in tandem, and people refer to astrology and astrological placements in order to cast spells.
Sorry, I interrupted you about the invisible when you were getting the invisible tattoo.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah. No, not at all, not at all. That's fine. Yeah, the first one I had was invisible, meaning it was done with oils. It wasn't, you couldn't see it. And it was a design of May Saraswati. Ajahn Nanting, he gave me my first Sakyant. Ajahn Nanting is a remarkable sorcerer. I mean, A1, very powerful sorcerer. And he gave me my first Sakyant. And he was, and still is, a great teacher. And I mean, the first experience I felt like literally I was being plugged into a power station. I've never experienced anything in my life. I still remember it to this day very clearly how I felt. It was overwhelming. And it takes years to process this stuff. And this is also a very, very slow form of magic. It isn't like suddenly, boom, tattoo, everything's different. It pervades slowly over time. And they each can work with each other. I would suggest, I mean, I noticed some people go out there and they said, I want to be completely covered. Well, personally, I had one to start with, and that was enough. Way, way enough, you know? And then over time, over years, I slowly became able to manage the weight of these designs. And they do carry a considerable amount of weight. I mean, some people have the double tigers immediately. Well, you know what happens when someone buys a Porsche as their first car? You know, they're going to crash. You know, it's a very powerful design, very powerful piece of magic, and you need to be able to manage it. You need to be able to have mastery over yourself. And once you have mastery over yourself, then you can move on to another form. It's a slow process. And some people, there was a great practitioner, Kruber Ponset. He said, I don't want to give anyone more than three at any one time. Only three designs. No more. And he was very strict about it. He's sadly no longer with us. But, you know, some people think in many different ways. I mean, in the book, I show very clearly the different forms of tattoos that I have. And also my back, it is completely full because I was being led to that decision. But that decision only evolved over time. It wasn't a lightly taken decision. It happened over time. And here we are today.
Darren, do you have any questions?
What about getting into the actual materials, the inks, the colors? Is there certain, nowadays you can get any sort of colors. They're all made with different dyes. I don't know where the dyes are coming from. Is there something to just, you know, the black, how they're doing that with, I think it was charcoal back in the day. I'm not totally sure. You probably know better than me. But is there something to those sort of like original ingredients versus today's modern inks and dyes, or if can the practitioner's sort of intention override that kind of stuff? Nowadays, we might be putting weirder stuff in our bodies, right? Before it seemed like even if there was, you were still putting foreign stuff in your skin, but there was like an organicness to it, right? It came out of the environment directly. We weren't making synthetic things and stuff like that.
Yes, it's a very good point. The tattoo, the Sakyant Sir Yen tattoo, the tiger tattoo that I had given to me, bestowed to me by Ajahn Tuli, that had the bile of a bear, the bile of a bear and a tiger mixed in with the ink. Now, no animals in this form can be killed deliberately. No life can be taken. So these creatures can only be accessed once they have passed. And Ajahns have many helpers who loyally and carefully source materials that stay within the Buddhist precepts. Do not take life is the first Buddhist precept. So Ajahns cannot knowingly use any form of animal products that have been killed deliberately for the purpose of, usually some kind of natural death or even a supernatural death. If a creature has been killed by lightning, that is highly prized. So they cannot use anything that's, you know. So I had tiger and bear bile. Bile from a bear and a tiger in the ink on a tiger tattoo that's on my arm. And this imbues it with extraordinary power, the bile of an animal. Now, I can't say that it's made my life better, but what I can say is this. I was given instructions by Ajahn Tuli to summon the spirit of the tiger. And in the book, I go into great depth of what happened when I visited Ajahn Tuli, and I strongly recommend that you read it, because what happened was what I would call a peak experience. I thought I was going insane. I went into a trance. And I started to take on the attributes of a tiger after he had applied the Satyam. Even before I got to his Samnak, even before we went through the rituals, weird things were happening. I mean, the car stopped, got out of it, and literally an amulet that I had was ripped off by some unseen force. It took me a while to find it. I describe it in the book. I mean, this is all happened. There's no rhyme or reason to it. I just record as a spiritual memoir, basically, a piece of hardcore reportage of what happened when I went to Thailand. It's a spiritual road movie, and I have done my utmost best not to misspeak or tell any lies or anything like that. It is straight from the heart, and it is from my field notes, and as I perceived it to happen. And this technology, this magical technology, once it is employed in the correct manner, the ink, yes, you're right, Darren, there are all many varieties and different ways of mixing the ink. And as for modern technology, I'm not sure. I don't have modern tattoos because the type of tattoos that I have are very highly specific and unique. They're not, you know, there's nothing modern about them. These are ancient designs. And they've been applied by a master of the art. I've had Sakyan tattoos from Ajahn Nanting, Ajahn Apachai, and Ajahn Deng. Ajahn Deng has done the majority of the work on my body. And each time that I've had these Sakyan tattoos, something else has happened and something is expanded upon. It's like a jigsaw. These different things happen, building up over time. So modern tattoo artists use extraordinary methods, but this is an ancient form. Yes, there are similarities, but the designs are ancient, and they've been handed down from master to student for countless years.
Did you, can we get back to that specific example? Did you say that you lost your amulet before you went into the tiger trance?
Yes, what happened was that we pulled up to his Samnak. I had this beautiful amulet on, and it was made by Ajahn Tui. And I got up, and it was a cat yantra amulet. And I have no idea, but I got out of the car. I didn't feel anything hit, pull, you know, I mean, I didn't feel anything. And we walked, and I just kind of checked to see if it was still there, just as we were going in. And it's like, oh, it's gone. And the actual cord had been frayed, it'd been ripped. Oh, how did this happen? I didn't feel, you know, something pull me along. I didn't feel anything like that. It'd literally been ripped off. So I panicked. This is a beautiful amulet, and I love it. And so I went back, checked. Went to the car, and there in the grass, right next to it, the amulet was sitting there on top of the long grass. And I was looking at it, going, how did it get there? You know, I got no explanation why this happened. Now, when I went in to see Ajahn Tui, he told me something. He said this: the night previous, I called upon the teacher spirits to come down this day to be here with us so that when you receive your Sakyam, you will receive the teachings. And I'm like going, you know, whoa. And the thing is, while I was there, and people in my party, they felt sick. Somebody had to step away because they felt physically sickened because the there's this invisible field which occurred during the ritual. And I felt like I was going to pass out, but I stayed the course. I've just got to keep breathing, you know, because I felt like passing out. And as I said, I went into this trance after it had been. I'll show you. There it is.
Yeah.
Right. It's in the book. This thing is, I mean, I've never experienced anything like it. I started panting and I said, I mean, I tried getting off the floor and I literally started assuming the shape of a tiger. And one of my party said, we saw this tiger shape just come out from you. And I said, what? Nobody was drinking or smoking pot. You know, it was all very sort of, you know, very sedate. And I just thought, what is going on? And see, the thing is, when you're involved, firstly, land spirits inhabit Thailand. When you go to Thailand, it's a very, very strong magical spiritual place, and there's density pockets of deep feeling in specific areas, and there are areas that, I mean, of course, everywhere is magical. I mean, where you are now, that's a magical place. But what I'm talking about is a characteristic that is specific to Samnaks, where they are placed, how they're placed, and then when someone summons teacher spirits to come down, the day of a ritual and that interaction between someone from the outside coming in and then having this ritual and then passing through an experience. You see, the thing about initiation is you can't make this up. You cannot fake it. It's not possible to fake initiation because it is imbued with feeling. And the feeling has to be true. It is based in truth. And there can be no way that you can fake it.
Then you're not initiated. I mean, if you fake it, you're not initiated.
It has to be felt.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I had this one Ajahn, it was he connected me to spirits. His name is Ajahn Sutep. He's a wonderful Ajahn. And we traveled quite a while to get to him. He's a country sorcerer. And he has an amazing capacity. And he's a wonderful Ajahn. And we spent a good 40 minutes. I was sat underneath a cloth going through this chanting, this ritual to connect me to the local spirits. And afterwards, he asked me, how do you feel? And to be honest with you, guys, I felt I was just going to levitate. You know, I just felt like I was high, you know, floating. I felt I was floating, literally, but I was obviously on the ground, but my insides were just pouring out. You know, I was just high without any drugs. And it was an incredible feeling. I'll never forget it. And I'd been connected to spirits. And they're still with me. I can still feel them. And once you get plugged in to a pathway, you're on that pathway for life, and I will die on this pathway.
That's fascinating. Well, I mean, I want to get into the sound stuff a little bit, but I also kind of have a question. It's sort of like the first question I asked or the earlier question about, you know, describing yourself as a Buddhist shaman, but how do you navigate the apparent tension between structured Buddhist practice, like we talked about before, and the more shamanic, animistic, or chaotic magical work?
You've just answered the question. There it is in a nutshell. And that is the quest of my life, is the balance.
Yeah.
The balance of that.
Yeah.
I posted something about belonging to briefly with a Zen Buddhist Facebook group. And you see, the thing is with doctrine, it's fine. Doctrine is fine. But when your spirit wishes to move somewhere, when you feel that you want to do something, your intuition is saying you need to do this now, you must always listen to your intuition, because it's informing you of something very important. By all means, keep precept, and I do that every day. But along with that, I have to balance, as you say, the shamanism, the shamanic instinctual side. So I call myself a Buddhist shaman. Firstly, my ex-wife, she called me a shaman. She said, "You're a shaman." And I said, no, I'm not. Yeah. And then I thought about it for years. And then I said, well, maybe I am, you know. And I would never call myself that. In fact, some people on social media said, oh, real shamans, they don't call themselves shamans. Yeah. And I said, well, I've heard that before. I mean, you are what you are. You are what you believe. You know, you can, I mean, if you believe in the flying spaghetti monster, and a lot of people do, great. I think it's wonderful. You can believe in whatever you wish to believe, because your mind is a projector and a receiver. Your mind is an open doorway and an open portal.
So is that...
Say something. You say something. Go on.
Darren, do you? I have something to say. If
you go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about playing around, and not, I'm not insinuating that you're playing around at all, but it's, how do I ask this? There's a lot of warnings about spiritual practices these days, especially, right? Like connecting with evil spirits, like not knowing if you're trying to connect these spirits, like you're asking your spirits to come down, like how do you protect yourself from the evil ones? How do you make sure that they are what they say they are? I think you answered it in what you just said about the belief and all that, and having to, you know. So I guess what I'm trying to ask is how much of that is based on your knowledge / initiative practice versus like belief and intuition or is there even a need to protect yourself from evil spirits, or because maybe you don't even believe that there is evil spirits?
Everyone has the capacity to be possessed. The smartphone is a portal to possession. I've seen people that I've known for years, calm, happy, reasonable, logical people, turn into right-wing extremists overnight. People have gone completely nuts. And it very, so much saddens me, because they've allowed their mind to be invaded by an idea that has lost any sense of reason, any sense of logic. You must base all of your decisions in logic. You have to think logically and carefully. You must have inner peace. Everything stems from that, because people create their own troubles. You know that, don't you? People create their own problems. People are their own demons.
So you're not worried about it because you're not creating your own demons, basically.
I'm not creating my own demons.
Yeah.
I recognize and I see demonic behavior. I see it. But I protect myself by returning to my inner self and seeking the calm through practices, meditational practices, that reset and aim to maintain a sense of calm. It's important to have reason and logic. While one is involved in practices, for example, I just did a ritual, excuse me. This is Kru Kai Kayu. And Kru Kai Kayu in Thailand is seen as a demonic character, but I don't believe he is. I believe Kru Kai Kayu is someone that has been perceived during a vision. A monk traveled around Thailand, and he went to Angkor Wat in Cambodia, and he meditated for, well, allegedly. I mean, there are many stories about Kru Kai Kayu, but the one that I like is the fact that he was perceived by a monk And a monk saw this vision, and then he started to create some form of statue from the visions that he'd been given while he was practicing. And so Krukai Keyu is like a father of the occult in Thai Buddhist practice, though he's not seen as a Buddhist deity. He is seen as a number of things. Some people do all sorts of things in order to praise him, which I don't agree with. Taking life, you know, killing animals. I do not agree with taking life in any way whatsoever. It disgusts me. But I give offerings to Krukai Keyu, fruit, candles, incense, flowers, non-destructive things. And the energy I receive from Krukai Keyu is very good. And so I feel it's a beneficial relationship. But if it's toxic, it's no good. And this is what one has to understand when one is dealing with occult forces. If it's toxic, if it's destructive, if it's hurting people, then don't do it. Krukai Keyu is a very wonderful deity if treated correctly.
Yep, going back to your precepts and the principles of Buddhism, the non-harm principles, the loving kindness, all that kind of stuff, will center you back to...
Is that based on sentient somehow then? Because some people would argue that those flowers are alive as well.
Of course, yes. They're an offering. They are alive, yes. Yes, they're alive.
So if they're like, if the flowers are picked, haven't you killed them?
Well, I bought them already cut.
Already picked? So does that work for consuming animals and things like that as well? If you is it the act of you doing it, or is it okay to like buy a burger from the store? Or how does you bought the flowers, can you buy meat?
No. Let me tell you about something that happened to me. I used to be a stand-up comedian in the 90s. And I did this benefit gig for Bosnia. I tried to do it. And I used to do this piece of stand-up comedy, which involved a piece of fresh fruit. Now, the thing is, one of the organizers said, and it was a Buddhist organization that was running. They said, sorry, you can't use this fruit because it's anti-life. Well, I mean, the fruit has already left the tree. It's already dead. So how is it anti-life? You know, I mean, yes, it's still a piece of fruit, and I respect it. But see, you know, you can go way off beam and lose all common sense when you take a certain pathway of belief. So I try to take the middle pathway with most things.
Because the fruit will fall off the tree eventually anyway. I mean, animals are destined to die eventually. There's sort of these different loops that are hooked in that you can get carried away on.
All things must pass. All things will pass. Everything. You know, everything is impermanent. You know? And you mentioned loving kindness. Loving kindness means having a mind that carefully looks at each aspect that you do. The kindness, loving kindness, it's a very specific term. And employing that means doing some things. I mean, I was a carer for my late mother for 12 years. And I witnessed her die of cancer, so I helped her. And there were some things that were traumatic for me to go through, but I did so because I knew it was a loving kindness thing to do for her, to care for her until her death. It was hard. Some things are very hard, but we do them because it's important to maintain a sense of decency, of kindness. We have to do these things. You know, it's we will all die, every one of us. Everything is impermanent. Our bodies, Everything is translucent and beautiful. Everything's translucent and beautiful.
Excellent.
Do we have time to go into the sound, your sound magic, the mystery and magic of sound? Any experiences where sound sort of acted like a weapon, portal, or healing force that people should know about?
Yes, there's one instance. Chanting mantras are a good thing for me.
Yeah.
When I was chanting, as I mentioned earlier, I really got into chanting the mantra of Padmasambhava. And I got to a point where I was chanting it a lot of times in Los Angeles, and this extraordinary thing happened. I was just in front of the shrine chanting, and then my grandfather appeared. And am I having a psychotic episode? So I'll keep chanting. And he appeared. And I haven't seen my grandfather in years. I mean, not since I was a child. He was a lovely old man. And he appeared in a vision, and he started doing this. Like that, and I was, oh, man. So I took note of it, and then I forgot about it. And then coming home from a meeting with the Agape Church, I came home and I was driving down the freeway, and there I turned to the right-hand side, and on this massive billboard, there were these words, "Come back home." And I suddenly realized what my grandfather was saying was, come back home, come back to Britain. You've done your time in the States.
Wow.
For now. And I thought, yeah, come back home. So I did. And over a period of months, I started preparing. I've been in Los Angeles for 7 years. I had no plans to leave. And I took it as a portent, as a message from my grandfather to come back to Britain. And I did that. And that's what prompted me to come from America, going from America, coming back to the UK. So once you plug into these things, once you start plugging into these things, and to appropriately discern, have appropriate discernment, and not getting it wrong. You know, it wasn't easy. It was something that I didn't particularly want to do because it was extremely difficult coming back after 7 years and having to start all over again.
Oh, yeah.
That was just really, and also leaving California, it was like coming out of hyperspace, you know? I mean, I'm serious. I mean, the way I lived there was like in hyperspace. And then coming back to a grey Britain, London, I was in London walking, and I mean, I nearly threw up in the street. I felt physically sick. It was so hardcore. It was very painful. But I went through it.
I could see that.
Because I knew my grandfather. He told me for a reason. There was a good reason as well. As it turned out,
reason was to care for your mother.
Yes.
So now that you've sort of through that, do you still plan to stay in Britain, or do you feel like that sort of was that response? Is that responsibly cleared now, or is it still calling to you?
No, I mean, my mother passed away in 2023, and she's passed, and that part of my filial duty has ended, and who knows? The world is an open book.
That's interesting. So you do believe that it was for that specific reason, so you could go back and be there with your mother instead of trying to deal with it all. I mean, I'm sure she appreciates it.
She wrote a letter to me before she passed, and she said pretty much what you just said, that she appreciated me. And we had a few laughs. You know, she was a great woman, and I do miss her.
So what do you plan on doing next?
I'm writing a new book.
What's that one called?
I don't want to give it away because okay. I'm kind of hankering for another invite on your show.
Let's do it when it comes out. Let's do it. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating.
I hope you invite me back.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a great chat. Before we do start to wrap up, is there anything about the book or anything we should have asked you that we didn't?
I can't think of anything. You know, a lot of people ask me, what should I do? I mean, people talk to me online and say, do you think I should have Sakyan? Do you think, you know, what can you teach me about it? Well, I've written a book. Please buy the book and read the book. It's all in there. I don't need to tell you anything because it's in a solid book with photographs, black and white and color, and it tells you all you need to know. I mean, one guy was saying to me, this very, very talented producer, he said, and I said, no, young man, go east, young man. Go to Thailand, get Sakyan. Go do it. I can't teach you anything. The book tells you everything. He said he'd read the book and he wanted to know more. I said, well, if you want to know more, you need to go. So, if you're interested in this subject, buy my book, then read the book, and then think about it. Some people, after reading it, think, do I really want to do this? I mean, as a travel book, it works very well. I mean, it is a spiritual road movie, you know? A lot happens, and that's why I had to write the book, because so much happened over 7 years. I mean, my father died, my sister died, my mother died, and the pandemic. A lot happened. And that's just world events and personal events. I mean, all the things that happened. I mean, I went through countless magical rituals. I lost count how many I went through. And they're all documented in detail in the book.
Are you going to do, are you going to narrate it yourself on audio? Have you ever thought about that? You have a nice English accent, a nice voice.
Well, thank you. I haven't been invited yet. I mean, I'd like to. My publisher, Inner Traditions, if you're watching, yeah. If you want to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I was wondering if they gave you the offer, if they offered to do it for you.
If you want to invite me to Vermont, I'll read it for you. I'm very happy to do that. It's something that I would like to do, but it's up to them.
Okay. Yeah.
I'd bug them about it because they are getting into it a little more. Probably if you read it yourself, that would help them out because they wouldn't have to pay for it. But I think like we run a publishing company and you're talking 3 or 4 to 1 on audio to print now.
Oh, really?
People love the audio.
Yeah. Audio has the new things where you've got all the pictures. You can attach accompanying PDF to it so that they can look at the pictures that you're talking about and that sort of thing. But yeah, I would, some of these older publishers, I mean, we work with Inner Traditions all the time. We know them really well. They're great. They send us books. They send us guests. They're fantastic. But some of these publishers aren't, we're a new company. So we kind of got into it on the audio side and then got into the print side. And it's just like, some of these older houses might not have figured out yet how far audio was coming. I know Jordan Peterson was saying his audiobook does 5 to 1 on his print.
Really? Well, that's amazing. I mean, you know, I've always bought books from Inner Traditions. I mean, my whole life, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like watching a League Division One football team. Not that I'm into football, but, you know, and then suddenly, you know, one of the major teams turns around and says, do you want to play football for us? And I'm going, what? You know, I mean, what, me published by Inner Traditions? Like, serious hardcore publisher, and I'm like, God, what's going on? You know, I mean, I'm still pinching myself. You know, I can't believe that happened. What, me, this small Welsh kid, you know, this little Welsh kid from Wales, you know, who's that? You know, how, what's that about? But there you go. You know, magic happens every day.
That's right.
Magic happens. Keep it happening. Shir Zed, Thai Tattoo Magic, the initiatory practices of the Thai Buddhist magicians. We appreciate you coming on the show. Do keep in touch. Let us know when that other book comes out, and we'll do this again.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight and pleasure to speak to you both. Thank you.
What's your website, and how can people get the book?
I have a link tree.
Okay.
I'm on Linktree.
Okay.
Okay. And it's Linktree Shir Zed.
Okay.
And, you know, just type into Google Thai Tattoo Magic, and that's magic spelt with a K, M-A-G-I-C-K, the Crowleyan way of writing magic. And it's available on Inner Traditions website, and it's available on Amazon. It's everywhere. It's across the galaxy. It's everywhere. If you want to seek it, you'll find it.
Right on.
Excellent. Well, enjoy your summer coming up. It seems like when that island is habitable, but the summers are
slightly, really,
it always blows my mind that, I mean, I'm in Canada, and it always blows my mind that most of your country is even further north than I am. I mean, I do still think sometimes I prefer the snow over what you guys get in the winter.
Yeah. I mean, Britain, you know, I mean, it's a national obsession, as you well know. I mean, people obsess about the weather and what it does and temporal climate. And yeah, it's a crazy little island.
You can start to understand why you guys went out and conquered the world. You were just sick of the rain.
Basically, that's it in a nutshell. You know, people, you know, traveled around on boats because sod this for a game of soldiers. I don't want to be here. It's bloody awful. Let's go and invade a country.
Yeah,
not
a sunny one.
You know, you know, just very silly behavior. Imperialism.
Yeah.
Big yawn. You know.
Cheers, Ed.
All right, thanks, Shir.
Thanks for taking some time out of your evening to come on the show. Keep up the good work and come back. Let us know when that book's out, and we'll do this again.
I will certainly do that.
Ciao for now. And that was a chat with Shir Zed, Thai Tattoo Magic. That was a good one. What'd you think?
Yeah, it was good.
He's got to get that audio book out. Got to bug those Inner Traditions people to get on it with the audio. And they, we did one for him. Maybe we could do more. Inner Traditions, if you're listening, we are for hire as well.
Well, those British accents really do.
And we would work out a deal with you guys.
I love those voices.
I mean, you guys are after giving us like 500 books over the decades, so. We appreciate it. Big thanks to Shir for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you're some of the people that support the show and to keep the show on the go. If it wasn't for these people, the show would not exist. So thank you to them. No ads, no back catalog, or no paywalls, no nothing. America.ca/support. If you're getting some value from the show, send some value back our way, and we'll keep doing the podcast. Check out GrimericaOutloud.ca for other show. contact@thecabin.com for trips and events. Going to Easter Island in about 3.5 weeks. There's still a couple spots left for that if you want to join. Solstice at Serpent Mound Festival coming up this summer, and some Randall Carlson stuff in the fall. Then adultbrain.ca for all those audiobooks and publishing company we talked about. Over 220 books on audio and a bunch more catching up on print and all that stuff. Disastermaps.ca is our new API, if you want to check that out and play with the globe and do all sorts of fun stuff. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Thank you.
fuel for your worries. But for God's sake, time is eternal. Please do not hurry. Please do not fret. Please act now in a way that doesn't lead to regret. So many cigarettes, so profusely.